Godspeed with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. Today we welcome back our guest, Miguel Connor, author of Voices of Gnosticism and commandeer of the site thegodabovegod.com. Miguel, welcome back to the Institute, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on again. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, now, in today's topic, the Kabbalah, the subject is both ancient, dating back to, of course, Babylon, and as well as contemporary, as modern-day celebrities have also recently delved into its mystery. Today, we hope to learn more about Jewish mysticism and hopefully debunk some myths as well. Miguel, to begin, if you could, what is Kabbalah?
Well, the Kabbalah is probably the main form of Jewish mysticism in modernity. The word itself means to be handed down or wisdom handed down. Now, it posits that, and again, in a lot of ways, and this is attested by the greatest scholar of Jewish mysticism, Gershom Scholem, who basically said that Kabbalah is a Jewish Gnosticism, and later on, if you want, we can touch upon how they might have, how they interacted and everything else.
Yes,
but,
of course.
It is a system in which the divine emanates itself from a sense of awareness and spreads out into different characteristics, coming down until it becomes a material world. The Kabbalah usually starts with what you call Ayin, and that means non-being. Maybe you ask, well, that doesn't sound something in the Jewish matrix, that God was once nothing. But what's very interesting is that if you look at the Torah, the word that most appears in the Torah is the word Ayin, which means non-being or non-existence. So the rabbis assumed that was the ultimate state of God. And then, of course, God became aware and spread out into light. And the highest part of, the next highest part in the Kabbalah is what you call the Ein Sof or Ein Sof Ur, which means a limitless light. And then, again, spreads down into these characteristics, which are 10. And these are the characteristics that are called the Sephiroth, which usually means vessels or emanations or circles. And each characteristic has a name for God, some that are negative or you might say more stern positive, such as mercy, judgment, victory, loving kindness. Mm. And this spreads out and emanates down into what you call Malkuth, which is stands for the kingdom. Now, this is, again, the Tree of Life or the Ex Chaim, the main diagram or mandala that the Kabbalists use. And it has 10 Sephiroth, usually based on because God had 10 commandments to create the world. And these are connected by 22 paths because the Hebrew alphabet has 22 letters. So the Kabbalists based pretty much all of their theology on this Tree of Life, or Esh Chaim, or it's often called the Adam Kadmon, which means the Holy Adam, since it's sort of the image of man that God has taken. And this, through this certain, I mean, again, of course, I must stress that there are many schools of Kabbalah throughout history. So
yes, and hopefully we can touch base a little on that as well.
Yeah, so it's hard to, there's many reasons. So the Kabbalah is a system of divine emanating itself until it reaches Earth, where the presence of God is, you might say, lesser, and here we are with the problem. The Kabbalah also stresses, like with Gnosticism, a divine, perhaps fallen, but redeeming female aspect. In Gnosticism, you would call it Sophia. In the Kabbalah, it's called the Shekinah of God. The Kabbalah, like with Gnosticism, believes in experiencing the divine and sort of going up the levels of the divine until you can reach the highest point through different methods, meditation, magic, prayer, righteous living, and other forms. With Gnosticism, it also posits that perhaps there was a cosmic cataclysm. In some stories, God created the first tree of life, and because he puts too much weight on the judgment part of himself, it collapsed and crashed. And this is called the breaking of the vessels. And the characteristics of God became lost in the world in what you call divine sparks. And God created then a second tree of life, and now we are here, and it is up to us to help God regain those vessels and get them back to it. There's an interesting concept in the Kabbalah, which is called Tikkun Olam. It's usually referred to as the mending of the vessels or the repairing of the world. There's also a term called Tikkun Elohim, which means the mending of the face of God. And this is actually from the Talmud, because the Talmud says God needs us as much as we need God. We are co-creators and co-redeemers with God. And by making the world better and ourselves better, we can repair what has been lost. Even if you don't believe in the cosmic cataclysm, we're down here in the last, in the place called Malkut, the kingdom, we can help God get divinity back up to him. So that's pretty much an overview of the Kabbalah.
Well, thank you, Miguel, that for that answer. And, you know, it brings to mind so many things, of course. I really enjoyed hearing about the mutuality there that you just explained between human beings and God in the Talmud. It brings to mind also that image of the rainbow as a covenant between God and human beings in Genesis. You know, it's a mutual relationship. Now the Kabbalah as mysticism and as other kinds of mysticism is a set of esoteric teachings in relationship between let's say the eternal and the mysterious and human beings. But what do we know of its origins? We know it was hidden basically for thousands of years. Do we know of its beginnings?
Well, I would say a lot of this is, again, legendary, and of course traditions always like to go back and say that, but I think most serious scholars would say that the Kabbalah started, now I'm not saying there wasn't Jewish mysticism, though it was very similar to the Kabbalah. There was a popular Jewish mysticism called Merkaba Judaism, which means chariot, because in the Bible, Elijah travels up in a chariot to the throne of God. So Jews in the times of Jesus and before believed that through certain rituals and meditations and so forth, they could take these astral flights up to God. And this Merkaba Judaism sort of evolved, and even in my book, Voices of Gnosticism, Marvin Meyer, who's the translator of the Nag Hammadi scriptures, he talks about how there was definitely an interaction between Merkaba Jews and Gnostics in those early days. But the Kabbalah itself, even though it likes to say, you know, it was handed down to Adam and Adam kind of kept it a secret, or when God gave Moses the Ten Commandments, he gave him the Kabbalah on the side only for those who deserved it, the, you know, those who are spiritually pure. But as we know historically, it probably started in the 12th century and probably started in southern France in what I always call one of those wonderful bursts of creativity and spirituality, like the Renaissance or the 60s or something like that. In southern France at the time, you had a community in which women were able to rule castles. You had Sufi pilgrims coming. You had the Cathars, the Gnostic Cathars. You had Knight Templars. And you had these mystic Jews. And they sort of started exchanging all these ideas. And later it moved on to Spain, to Girona. And that's what most people say is the true birth of the Kabbalah as we know it. So it was 12th or 13th century where the mature, fully formed Kabbalah pretty much started.
Well, there must have been something going on at that time, because that is a time of a huge amount of activity and spiritual, you know, spikes on the timeline, as it were. You know, the Franciscans were getting going then, and so was Teresa of Avila. A lot of things happening 12th, 13th century along the mystical timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And now, so from there, did it become, did it remain hidden? Did it become systematized? Or how do we know of this?
Oh, no. It became actually very popular with the Jewry, and it also began to, by the Renaissance. Many of the Jews believed that the Kabbalah was a gift, you know, the Torah and the Talmud were for the Jewish people, the Israelites. But they believe that the Kabbalah is something that should be shared with the world to make the world a better place. So not only did the Kabbalah become very popular with the Jews, it also started spreading into Christian circles, as many Renaissance magicians who took on the Kabbalah. Even there's even a form of Islamic Kabbalah and so forth. And it became very popular up until about the, I believe it's the 17th century. There was a Kabbalist called Shabbatai Zevi. And when I talk to my Jewish friends, they always say, oh, he was just a nut. And they really don't want to talk about him, because Shabbatai Zevi was the most popular Messiah that Judaism had ever encountered. I mean, he was far more popular than Jesus to the Jews. He was he began to have mystic visions. And suddenly all of Europe and all of the Middle East started just, you know, selling their houses off, taking pilgrimages, going to him, because they really thought he was a Messiah and he was a Kabbalist extraordinaire. The problem that happened is that the Sultan of the Ottoman Turkish Empire said, whoa, this guy is causing trouble because all these Jews are mobilizing in my empire. So he sent people out to bring him Shabbatai Zevi. But every time he tried, his soldiers would come back, we cannot arrest him. And this is in his own biography by Gershom Scholem, we cannot arrest him. He is too holy for us. So then the Sultan of the Ottoman Turkish Empire actually had to broker a deal with some of his underlings to have Shabbatai Zevi come. Shabbatai Zevi came to the Sultan of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and the guy said, look, you're going to cause pure chaos in my kingdom. I'm giving you two choices, either convert to Islam or I'm going to banish you somewhere where nobody will ever find you. And very strangely, Shabbatai Zevi decided to convert into Islam, and it takes like 10 minutes to put on a hat and you utter the names of God and whatever. And the Sultan was satisfied with that. And interesting is the Sultan always gave Shabbatai a high place in his own court. I mean, the man was just known as just an incredible, holy, mystic prophet. But the problem is that this crushed the psyche of all the Jews who, of course, like with Jesus, they were expecting a Messiah that would free them and send them back to Israel and get the Muslims off their back. After this, most of the rabbis started denigrating Kabbalah, calling it pure nonsense and pure hocus-pocus and bad magic and all that. And even though a lot of Kabbalist groups still remained there and actually became very active in overthrowing the Ottoman Turkish Empire later, it became kind of a bad name with the Jews until the Hasidic Jews in the 18th century revived the Kabbalah, but they kept it pretty much to themselves. Even today, the Hasidic Jews are very private about their Kabbalah usage. And then again, in the 19th century, we have a big occult revival, which happens in Europe. And such groups as the Golden Dawn and whatever started creating their own types of Kabbalah. You have the Hermetic Kabbalah, the Christian Kabbalah got revived, and so forth. So the Kabbalah now has basically had a sort of a revival since the 18th, 19th century and so forth.
Thank you very much, Miguel. A lot of information there. And now for those who around the world who are listening who may not be familiar with you know, certain categories, could you just describe briefly before we move on the Hasidic Jewish community and in terms of their basic way of life, and would you know how they utilize Kabbalah?
I'm not really that familiar with them because, again, they keep it very hidden. Their type of Kabbalah is a lot more dogmatic and strict. I don't think it's as mystical as other types because there's the magic Kabbalah where you utter the names of God and you try to go up the tree of life and results happen. There's the meditative Kabbalah where if you meditate on the names of God, you will become holy and spiritual and so forth. Then there's just the practical Kabbalah, which you can take ideas and make yourself a better person through your daily life. So I think that's what the Hasidic Jews really follow. I mean, the main book of the Kabbalah is what you call the Zohar, which came out around, again, the 13th century. And it means splendor. It's called the Book of Splendor, and it's a giant book with all these rabbis talking and interpreting the Torah different ways. And you get some, like the Gnostics, you get some amazing interpretations of the Torah, especially the Book of Genesis. I mean, the Gnostics and the Kabbalists were obsessed with Genesis like nobody else. For example, the Bible starts with, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. Well, the Kabbalists kind of switched some of the letters. They found, you know, because obviously in Hebrew a word can mean different things. And they came up with the concept, and they read it as, in the beginning it created God. And they said to themselves, wow, so Yahweh is not the ultimate God. There is a God above God, if you would. And another interpretation, they saw the Garden of Eve, and they changed some words around. And they said, no, God never threw Adam and Eve out of the garden. Adam and Eve threw God out of the garden. The garden is still there, but because they don't have God's presence, they can't see that they're standing right in front of paradise. So as we as humans would just act holy and connect with God, we would open our eyes and see that we are still in the middle of paradise. And that's very much like the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. It says, you know, the kingdom is all around you, but you do not see it.
That is powerful. Powerful spin on that, isn't it?
Oh, the Kabbalah, especially the Zohar, and some of they've got some beautiful ideas that are just, they're breathtaking. I mean, it's a complete different, it's an amazing way of looking at the world. And, you know, it's probably another reason many Jews, even today, talk about it as magic and New Age and hocus, but the Kabbalah is very pantheistic. I mean, God is pretty much everywhere. and all we have to do is sort of recognize it.
Mm. Now, would you say that is in large part the purpose of Kabbalah, is the mystical practice that helps us to sort of take that veil away and see the wonder and the magic of what is actually here?
Actually, yeah, you're very right, because the Zohar has all these beautiful stories. Like, it has a story, there's always like a woman, and she comes to the court of the king, and, you know, she keeps asking the king, take off my veils. And the king takes up one veil, and he learns one lesson, and then takes up another. And suddenly he realizes that, oh, she is the Shekinah of God, the female princess, the female part of God that is lost in the world with humanity. And then they have this romantic marriage, which is a marriage between, you know, Israel. Of course, to the Kabbalists, Israel means the whole world, not just the Jewish. And they have this wonderful marriage. So there's all these beautiful metaphors and allegories in the Zohar and the Kabbalah that just go on and on.
Now we're hearing words like the Tree of Life and the princess and the veils and all these images that are coming to mind. Kabbalah appears very rich in symbolism. And, you know, even just perusing online, there's just many, many, many symbols involved with Kabbalah. Could you share about perhaps some main or major symbols or combinations of symbols and what they mean and how they might be utilized?
Well, again, you'd have to go back to the Tree of Life. That is the centerpiece of the Kabbalah. And this gets interpreted in so many different ways. I mean, the Zohar is just a gigantic book. And then you have the writings of the Muslims and the Christians and the occultists. You could just interpret it in so many ways. I mean, some people, you know, talk about how the Kabbalah itself is, you know, is this archetypal image that looks like the DNA strand, and you can use it for so many things. For example, there was Eliphas Levi, the great occultist, who was able to put the Kabbalah and the Tarot into one system, and he created his own form of magic. So in a sense, it's almost like the flexibility of the Kabbalah comes with dozens of different systems of mysticism, and as well as dozens of systems of interpreting the symbolism that is there. It really is endless. I don't really have a preference, since I find them all very fascinating. Again, the ten Sephiroth symbolize the aspects of God that we have to understand, and some of them can be more severe, and some can be not. What is fascinating is that Malkuth, the bottom of the Tree of Life, and of course the tree itself is a very powerful symbol that we find in all mythology, which is basically this axis mundi, the center of the world, this giver of life that you can find in Norse mythology and all other, a whole bunch of other mythologies. But at the bottom we have Malkuth, the kingdom, and only a fraction of the kingdom is really the material world. To be able to get to the characteristics of God, we're talking about a supra-spiritual place. I mean, something that is beyond our thoughts. You know, a lot of Kabbalists say, don't even worry about Ayin or the higher levels of God, like wisdom or understanding, because they are beyond you. You know, focus down here on mercy and on victory and beauty and fixing the world and reuniting yourself with the Shekinah. So it's pretty complicated and endless when you think of all the systems.
Yes, and the images of the Tree of Life are just beautiful, with you know, all the sort of branches reaching up, as well as the roots reaching down in a kind of almost a Celtic mandala kind of thing you run into pretty often. Sort of cyclical and having that feeling of connection, you know, to life and to the eternal and the cycle of life. as you know, life and death and life and that kind of nourishment of the tree, relating to human beings as well. How does the Kabbalah relate to the rest of the Jewish faith? In other words, is it something outside, practiced, by some people, or is it something, sort of in the middle of, you know, weekly worship or family life?
No, the Kabbalah, again, is not, it's very split between the different Jewish, sects that we have today. I mean, Orthodox and conservative Jews really dislike it. Hasidic Jews are really into it. Reformed Jews are definitely very, very positive to it and approachable to it. So it really depends. But again, the Jews take it very seriously. It's not something that, as a lot of occultists or New Agers today will just, you know, kind of approach. They believe that the Kabbalah, or to learn the Kabbalah, is a lifelong pursuit, and only if you are really going to dedicate your life to it should you even bother. Obviously, the other religions, Christians, you know, Muslims, and you know, pagans and occultists feel that no, it's very approachable, and we can use it, and we can mix and match and blend it in with our own spiritual practices. And a lot of people do, and they come up with their own personal insights. So.
Which is lovely. Thank you very much. We're about halfway through the program. Miguel, we're going to just stop for a moment for station ID. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take a short break, but after the break, we'll continue our conversation on Kabbalah with author Miguel Connor. I need to spend a couple of minutes with Barbara right now, but stay with us.
Just tell me where. Tell me where.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're speaking about Kabbalah with author Miguel Connor. Miguel, let's talk about, as Barbara was just singing about picking fruits from every tree, what are the fruits of Kabbalah, and not even just that, but the mystical life in general, and if you wish, also Gnosticism?
Well, obviously it would be the reunion with God and the knowledge of God, which of course is very much in line with Gnosticism. In the Kabbalah, in the Kabbalah you are meant to rise through the levels of God until you can reach the apex of God. In Gnosticism, you travel through the different heavens until you can find the source of the true divinity. Of course, this is also practiced in a lot of other religions like Buddhism and Neoplatonism and Hermeticism. So that would certainly be the way to it. But of course, you know, as we talked about the mending of the world or the mending of the face of God, in Judaism, behavior is extremely important. So following the Torah, being a righteous person, being a good person, that itself is just as important to heal the world as anything else. So that would definitely be the some of the goals of the Kabbalist.
And in terms of reunion with God, it's an interesting concept because, you know, are we not in union with God?
Yes, we are. But as the Zohar and others said, we don't know this. Again, it's the whole concept of the veil, the whole concept that we've thrown God out of the garden. It's also the concept of balance, too. The Kabbalah always talks about how everything should be balanced, and one of the balances that it certainly believes in is the balance of the male and the female aspects of creation of this world. The Kabbalah, especially many modern Kabbalists, certainly believe that we have tilted the tree of life, if you would, has tilted too much toward the patriarchal, the harsher part of God, and it should tilt to the side of the female, because the tree of life itself is split downward and has a left hand and a right hand, and one is female and one is male. So the concept of balance is very important. Inner balance and outer balance is very important. I spoke about Gershom Scholem, and Gershom Scholem was very influential on Carl Jung and his ideas of the male and female within us. And, of course, Carl Jung then drew upon the Gnostics, who talk a lot about that, too. Gershom Scholem was also very influential on Joseph Campbell and his work. So these are definitely some of the things that the Kabbalah stresses out. There's some very radical schools of Kabbalah. After, like I talked about, Shabbatai Zevi converted, one of his followers, Jacob Frank, and to this day we still have Frankian Kabbalists. They believe that the way to holiness, because of Shabbatai Zevi's conversion, was to experience every religion completely. In other words, the follower should convert to Christianity and follow with all of your heart to understand it, and then convert to Islam and follow with all your heart to understand it. Today, some of these Neo-Sabbatian or Frankian Kabbalists will go and they'll become Hindu, they'll travel to India and become Hindu and all that. And once you have an understanding of all these religions, that's when the tree of life or the true Kabbalistic spirit becomes apparent. There's a similar school with the Frankians who said the only way to be holy is to break the commandments of God. And, of course, the caveat is as long as you don't, infringe on another human being's rights. In other words, you don't go around killing people or robbing people. But no, you break some of the commandments, you meditate upon them, you see what it feels like to be in the darkness, and then you hopefully, meditate yourself into the light. It's sort of very strange views, but these are some of the views of Kabbalah. And of course, I should mention that I would say most Kabbalists believe in reincarnation, which definitely puts them out of touch with a lot of the mainstream Jews.
This is fascinating, what you're sharing. And I want to talk about that, about reincarnation, but what you mentioned before about the striving for balance, and I mentioned Carl Jung, and of course his anima and animus, and it brought to mind the yin and yang. And it seems to me there's this desire basically across so many trains of thought and so many religions to seek not only the unveiling of the wonderful reality before us, but also that balance that always seems to be coming up. So would you say that the Kabbalah, works with other faiths or complements other religions around the world?
Oh, I would say so, and it's definitely been used by different religions. And I think, like I said before, when the Kabbalah came out in the medieval ages, they did believe this was something that needed to be shared with the world, not the, they weren't going to, Judaism is not a proletizing religion. It's not about converting people. So, of course, they were going to keep the Torah and the Talmud and, have their own communities. But the Kabbalah was something that should be shared with other religions. And, I know a lot of occultists. I know a lot of pagans. I know a lot of magicians. I certainly know a lot of Gnostics. And they all have, or a big majority have, used the Kabbalah in some way or another to help them with their spiritual growth. Because there's so many fascinating ideas that can really light something in your brain. for example, probably one of the greatest Kabbalists is a man named Isaac Luria, and he was a Kabbalist who really crystallized the whole idea of the Kabbalah. And one of his ideas is that he went and said, look, how can God create when God is everything? I mean, it's like being a giant elephant in a room, and you're in a room and there's no space. So he came up and people said, well, yeah, it kind of makes sense. If God is everything, why create? And so he came up with the idea. He said, well, what happened, God had, and this doctrine is called the Zin Zum, God had to basically inhale himself. He had to take a gigantic breath and constrict himself and leave a little bit of space in the chaos, and then he could create, you know, heaven and earth and everything else. But the problem is some of this darkness kind of got lost, and that's how we got that's how we have evil in the world. And you know, then you talk about, you know, obviously the usual Kabbalistic way of fixing this world, which again is, you know, meditating on the Tree of Life, the rituals on the Tree of Life, and again, with Judaism is living a righteous, holy life. So we can, again, be co-creators and co-fixers with God. You know, we need each other.
Yes, yes, and we know that more and more every day. Has Kabbalah been misused?
I would say it probably has. And in fact, I would say that without a doubt. But I really don't want to name names. I think
right.
I think a lot of these celebrities and groups that are out there these days have diluted the Kabbalah and made it pretty too commercial for my good, and I'm not too keen on them. I think a lot of occultists and magicians who are not about spiritual growth, but about using magic for material benefit, which I
like a good luck charm.
Yeah, well, you know, magicians that want, you know, the beautiful girl, or they want their boyfriend back, or they want to win the lottery. You know, those type of, they want to change the material world, but they don't want to change their spiritual world. Those who use the Kabbalah, I am not too keen on. So, I mean, like anything, any spiritual practice, it can be misused, it can be corrupted, it can be diluted, and it can be turned into something horrible when it is really something very wonderful. I mean, it's human nature.
Yeah, I know. That reminds me of that song, everyone wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die. you know, there are no shortcuts, you know, to spiritual growth, and it is a journey and a lifelong journey and commitment. You mentioned reincarnation before. Can we discuss that regarding, I guess this would be an, you know, early Jewish belief and part of Kabbalah?
Well, actually, it's not exclusive to Kabbalah. Some Jews do accept reincarnation because they would. There's a line in the Bible where God says, "I will inflict curse upon your fourth generation." And the rabbis would say, well, why is God doing that? Why is he not punishing this generation that was wicked, and he's waiting till the fourth generation to punish them? And they said, what was probably happening is this reincarnation is happening, and God is simply going to nail them down the line, sort of as a karma thing, if you would. So, and that was a belief how a lot of Jews came with the incarnation, and they call it the Gilgul, which means the wheel, you know, the wheel that keeps going around and rotating. Now,
yeah.
The Kabbalists have really fascinating. I myself am I'm kind of agnostic on reincarnation, or I'm open-minded on it, or I'm waiting for more downloading from the divine before I can make a stance. But the Kabbalah actually is a very, I think, more advanced than most religions' concept of the reincarnation, because in the Kabbalah, you don't reincarnate forward, But because, after all, your spirit or divine spark or soul is not tethered to time and space. So you could actually, let's say you and I die, we could actually be reincarnated sometime in the past, 1,000 years in medieval times or whatever. And these, and we will be given a sort of a karmic duty to help again mend the world and help God. And so therefore these sparks are just like reincarnating all across time. And even more fascinating is that not necessarily one soul has to be inside the body. In the Kabbalah, you could actually have two divine sparks in you. One is from some person and one is you, or, and each of them has their own karmic quest that they have to do. And if one does it, then that spark leaves you and then you live here. So it's just like this amazing traffic. And I actually find it very logical. I mean, why can't we hold different souls in our body, and why should we reincarnate just down, you know, linear time when
right.
we are beyond time, or do we could be all over the place?
That's right, especially if everything is, you know, now.
Mm-hmm.
If there is like an eternal now, you know, the linear time frame is what we've negotiated for ourselves in our day.
Yeah,
day.
Exactly.
You know, it also sounds as though the concept of reincarnation in that context is not perhaps merely just for an individual, but also for a people, a generation,
right.
Going into their new life or their future or past together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
As a society.
Yeah, or if there is a. Because Kabbalah talks about different characters in the Bible that might not have resolved their problems. And then it says, well, then they resolve their problems later on as this and this person. So you might have to resolve your problem or issue with somebody or some cause or something, but that doesn't mean it will be forward in time. You might have to, you know, let's say you and I have to resolve something or go on a great quest. We might have to do it in the, you know, French Revolution or something like that.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Or the beginning of time, you know, we go back to Adam and Eve and we've got to figure things out. So it's I find the Kabbalah concept of incarnation really the most fascinating, if not more, advanced that I've seen.
It also, from the way you describe it, feels very liberating. My favorite, you know, of the four Gospels of the New Testament is John, because he plays with time in the beginning, and he plays with, you know, what is in the beginning and before the beginning, and all of that, which I appreciate. It reminds me, I remember Field of Dreams, where the whole thing is leading up to the last 5 minutes of the Father reconciling the Son to Himself, but the Father is younger than the Son.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it's playing with time, you know, but in our, you know, on our, in our sphere and in our earth and, you know, in our field, which I thought was
right.
very liberating and powerful.
Yeah, because Isaac Luria, and who came up with many of these concepts, he was obviously a person of very advanced spiritual nature. I mean, he could talk to. He never wrote a thing down. I mean, it seems like a lot of the greats, like Buddha or Jesus or Muhammad or some of the others, they never write anything down. It's always they simply talk. They just don't have time to sit down and write. And Isaac Luria would walk around with his students, and he would sit there and suddenly have these conversations with these spirits out of nowhere. Or he could go, he would love, like, kind of like William Blake did, he could go into a graveyard and speak to these people, and sometimes his followers would realize that even if the graveyard was, the tombstone was unmarked, they would find out that he was right, he was speaking to that person he said he was speaking, or they'd find, or he'd say some fact about this person, and then they'd go and look it up and say, oh my God, this person really did this. So, Isaac Luria was definitely, he was on another level, I guess the level that all of us would love to attain, you know, this great holy man who basically saw beyond time and space.
Mm. Now, in our time and in our space, with our all of our conflict in our societies, as well as beauty, of course, and love and friendship, but with all of our challenges as well, what kind of spiritual tools can working or studying with the Kabbalah offer us in our life or in our society?
Well, again, of course, the Kabbalah will always go to the Tree of Life, and I would venture for a person, because obviously each one of us will come to a different insight on it, get a diagram of the Tree of Life and begin studying what each of the characteristics of God is and what each different path represents. Obviously, you should have some knowledge of Judaism and mystic Judaism, because when I first saw the Tree of Life, I was like, what the heck is this? Oh, wow, some crazy diagram. I didn't see anything. But when I started reading about the history and the prayers and the meditations and all that of the Kabbalah and the Zohar, it was great. Somebody I would advise to read. Gershom Scholem's great, but he's very, very dense and scholarly. He leaves no stone unturned. I mean, his writings, I mean, he goes into Lilith, the angel Metatron, everything that's associated with the Kabbalah, he completely goes into. But somebody who I think is wonderful, and I've actually had him on my show, is a best-selling author called Daniel C. Matt, M-A-T-T. Any of his books on Jewish mysticism, including his book on the Zohar, Annotate and Explain, are excellent, excellent eye-openers and soul-openers and chakra-openers to really understanding the Kabbalah. I mean, I love one passage he writes. He's talking about heretical thinking, and he says, you know, thinking about God is a form of idolatry, because that's what we create in our mind, a vision of God, and we all of a sudden, each one of us has put up an idol that is not God. So thinking about God is heresy. So stop thinking about God. And of course, that's kind of Zen Buddhist, but it makes sense when you think about it or not think about it.
No, that's great. That really is. Thank you. But now you say, you know, you got into it and it was eye opening. So just speaking for you, just for Miguel, how did it help your understanding or perception?
Well, for me, because I mean, to me, I must admit that the Kabbalah doesn't speak to me as much as the Gnostic mythology or cosmology does, but to see how in the realm of myth and Genesis, things can be moved around and toyed with and tweaked with, we can find our own little revelation, inner revelations about things. You know, I mean, we all think, you know, Genesis and the Bible is set in stone. But when we're giving different interpretations by these great wise people like the Kabbalists or the classic Gnostics, we find little revelations that help us in our own spiritual life. And, you know, I've done exercises where, you know, I meditate on the Kabbalah and I try to go up and down and I try to find the balance in it, the idea of Ayin and how it, God is nothingness. And again, it's not thinking about an image of God, and helps me instead of helps me to try to experience God and sort of trick my mind and trick my ego. And I have a lot of different things that I've said. Of course, I happen to be a dualist. I believe that I'm not as positive as most people. I kind of think that we do live in a prison. I think I mentioned it in the last show. And in some of the Kabbalah texts, when the first Adam collapsed, the shards that held the divine light are called the kelipa, and these are wasted shards of existence. And the Kabbalah says these are beings that are far more evil than demons, and that will try to get us off our path. And I enjoyed that mythology, not because I, you know, have ever met a demon or seen the devil or, you know, or anything else, but it keeps me on my toes saying, you know, maybe not evil, but there's always something that's going to try to get me off my path. These Kelopoth or these Archons that are going to throw me off my path, whether it's the, you know, the lady from the cable company who gets me so mad and during the day or my car won't start or so, you know, there's always going to be part of the world that is trying to get me off my path. So by taking this kind of, you know, negative view of the world with these demons who I don't believe in, it helps me stay very focused and concentrated. But
no, that's great, and that's very useful because, you know, I call it the irritant, you know, those things that do that. But I try to keep in mind the, you know, the image of the oyster, the irritant. When it gets irritated, is what makes a pearl.
Yeah,
but you know, because it gets sand inside and it starts to get irritated, and so I try to find the potential pearls in my irritants. But it helps to have a tool like that to keep you on the path. We have a couple of minutes left here on the program, and you know, you mentioned shards just now and earlier when you were talking about the belief of you know, going fully through all the religions in the world to get that you know, the clarity of God, basically. The similar image came to me about facets, you know, different facets on one you know, diamond. You need all the facets to see this jewel. And in some ways, that's, you know, part of our work here on this program. We invite everyone. We speak with everyone. We want to hear everyone's beliefs and get to know each other better, because we feel very strongly that's the way forward.
No doubt that, and of course the Kabbalists and Gnostics would agree there is no such thing as too much knowledge. And especially when it comes to the knowledge of other spiritualities and everything, you know, things will click and things will break through. As you know, as Jesus said, if you keep knocking, and you can always discard what doesn't work for you and then really go for the gold. So, and I think the Kabbalah is useful because, again, it fits in with so many religions.
Yes, and we've spent such a long time turning away from each other, being afraid of each other, that we're poised right now, and I think we're, you know, at this moment where we face each other now and learn to stand together more as our, you know, the human family we really are when we take that veil away. And people like you help me to learn these things. And I want to thank you now as we approach the end of the show. If people would like to learn more about your work, Miguel, where should they go?
My website is thegodabovegod.com. Of course, that's both something that fits in Kabbalah and Gnosticism. So there I have all my resources where you can, my books, my essays, I have my podcast shows up there, and a whole bunch of other heretical goodies that make fundamentalists just really mad.
Oh, dear. Well, they're invited to.
Yes, they are.
But I want to thank you.
Okay,
yeah,
I
just want to thank you again for being with us. Always a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This show was recorded on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Barry Dwyer and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com, where you can find my works on the spiritual core of relationships, as well as a library of others around the world. Please send your comments to contact@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always love to hear from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.